Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Now, this episode comes to you as part of the Hay Book Club and was the Literary Festival's choice of the book for October. It is Bewilderment, which of course made the Booker Prize shortlist. Richard Powers is the author. He's published 13 novels. He's a MacArthur Fellow and he received the National Book Award. His last book, The Overstory, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, as was this latest one that we're speaking about. Richard lives in the Great Smoky Mountains. Richard, where are the Great Smoky Mountains?
They're in southern Appalachia. They lie mostly between Tennessee and North Carolina. And interestingly, they weren't on my personal map in the United States. I'm not sure I could have pointed a finger directly at them before I discovered them myself on a research trip for my previous novel, The Overstory.
And so how did you come to live there permanently?
When I was reading for The Overstory, I read a great deal about trees. I read everything I could put my hands on and ended up reading more than 120 individual book-length studies of trees. And I became fascinated with the forests of North America, the four great forests that had covered the continent. And I was shocked to discover how little primary forest there is still left, uncut forest, virgin forest in the U.S., something on the order of 2 to 5% of the original forests that covered the continent. That's just sort of a stunning figure to me. And I kept reading that if you wanted to see what old growth forest, what eastern deciduous broadleaf old growth forest looked like, that the Smoky Mountains was a place to go because it is the largest extant contiguous chunk of old growth forest that's left on the continent. And I arranged a short research trip there, 3-day trip up into the southern Appalachians to see what primary forest looked like. While writing this book, I thought, I had to take at least a peek. I'm an Easterner myself. I grew up east of the Mississippi, and I thought I had a pretty good sense of what broadleaf forests looked like in the eastern part of the country. But when I got to the Smokies and I made my way up a trail through the recovering forest and into the old growth, it was stunning. From one step to the next, there really was a very pronounced boundary between the recovering and the old growth forest. And I've compared it elsewhere to that moment in The Wizard of Oz where the film goes from black and white to color. It smells different. It sounds different. It looks different. The light is different. The species count is way up. And it was a very moving experience for me. I thought, this is my first glimpse at a fully functioning, intact, healthy forest. This is my country's patrimony, and there's almost none of it left. And that impression, that sense of health and well-being that I got from walking through the old growth was so intense that 8 months later, I found that I was still thinking about it. And I thought, well, that has to tell you something. And I went back and I bought a house nearby. And I've been living there ever since for the last 5 years. And I've just had this remarkably wonderful, good fortune to have 500,000 acres of wilderness in my backyard and, one quarter of that being this marvelous treasure of uncut primary forest.
And do you think the location has changed you as a writer?
Well, it has changed me in every measurable way. It changes the way that I write, how I structure my day, and it certainly has changed what I write about. I wrote Bewilderment under lockdown, and it shows. I got locked down in this incredibly lucky place, and the Smokies really dominates this book. The book begins in that setting, it ends in that setting, and it is the dominant setting for the interaction between the father and son that comprises the bulk of the drama in the book. The way in which it's changed me as a writer has to do with the way that I structure my day. You mentioned that this is my 13th novel. And for the first 11 and a half, I felt pretty indifferent to place. I felt like my work as a novelist took me to places both psychological and intellectual, that I really could write about anywhere. And I would wake up in the morning and I would, you know, get all the urgent business off my desk, and then I'd start working, and I would not leave until I had my 1,000 words. I was treating writing as a very product-oriented activity, and I defined myself as the person who could do this, keep this regimen, and produce books at that clip. In the middle of the Overstory, when I did move down to the Smokies, my relationship to my work and the job of living where I live almost inverted. Instead of waking up in the morning and saying, make yourself into a writer, I would wake up in the morning and go out on the deck and say, what's happening out there? Where am I? What time of year is it? What's the weather? What are the animals doing? What's in fruit? What's in flower? Where is the best place to be right now in order to discover what this piece of earth under my feet is trying to do? And, you know, living there has become the priority, and everything that follows from that has become the bonus. I will say that being out in the woods and walking is so stimulating that it usually is the case that I don't have to go more than a couple of miles before my head is filled with voices and characters and scenes and sentences. And often I'll turn around and rush back to the trailhead in order to get home and jot down all the ideas that occurred to me in the forest. So I'm probably still producing at roughly the same rate, but the words are coming from the place and from my experience of being among the neighbors and in this texture of the more than human.
Can you introduce us to the three characters, two alive and one dead, at the heart of the novel?
The book is told exclusively in the first person by Theo Byrne, who's a 39-year-old astrobiologist. And, you know, for those who haven't come across the term, astrobiology is a very young discipline. In fact, it didn't even exist when I was Theo's age. It's come on very quickly in the last few decades, and it concerns itself with the broadest questions about the possibilities and affordances of life. Under what conditions can life begin? How easy or difficult might that be? What are the extremes of circumstance that make life possible or impossible? Is it perhaps ubiquitous, or are we dealing with an extremely unlikely single case here on Earth? All of these questions about the broadest potential and agency of life taken in the aggregate. And of course, that means exploring all of these new exoplanets that have been popping up by the thousands now in the last couple of decades, and asking whether or not any of these places might be able to be a site for life, and what life might look like there. Would it have the same chemistry as ours? Would it be an entirely different kind of proposition? So that's Theo's day job. However, the bulk of his efforts are taken up with being the father of 9-year-old Robin Byrne. Robin is an extremely intense, unusual boy. He has lost his mother 2 years before the novel begins. Alyssa dies when Robin is 7 years old. And perhaps aggravated by the loss of his mother at such an early age, perhaps also a function of his intrinsic difference, Robin is having trouble. He's spinning out of control. He's recently attacked one of his schoolmates. He's experiencing great anxiety, great difficulty in controlling his behavior. And Theo, left alone to raise this boy by himself, is a bit at a loss. Alyssa, Theo's wife and Robin's mother, despite the fact that she is now 2 years dead, also haunts these pages. There's a kind of ghost story. She is very present in the memory of both Theo and Robin. And one never goes too many paragraphs without the memory of Alyssa playing some role in the father and the son's relationship.
I mean, you go out of your way to not label him. You use the term neurodivergent. Why that antipathy to actually giving it any kind of diagnosis?
Well, Theo actually does bring Robin into the doctors. But as is often the case with parents of extraordinary children, he gets more than one diagnosis, and he gets changing diagnoses. And as a scientist, he concludes that this may be symptomatic of just how rough and uncertain the process of mental health diagnosis in children really is, and how fluid it is, and how sometimes, you know, crude and approximate it is. And so when he does get the recommendation from at least one doctor to medicate his child and to control Robin's behavioral problems that way, which is quite common in the United States, he pushes back against it. For better or worse, he's saying he thinks that his boy is too young, his brain is still developing, and he's not ready to experiment on Robin in quite so drastic a way. And for better or worse, he makes this decision, and it has great consequences for the rest of the story. But this question of what is wrong with Robin, of course, slowly becomes another question, which is when Robin asks his father, what is wrong with adults that they're letting this world become what it's becoming and even pushing it along faster? Perhaps there is something in Robin's question that's just as valid with regard to mental health. That also becomes the subject of the story.
It's really a love story, or in fact, more than one love story. Love stories, it happens on so many levels. And I just wondered if you'd unpack that for us and talk a little bit about the empathy that's at the heart of the book.
Yeah. So the first love story is certainly the love that Theo has for his boy. Although he admits to his own son uncertainty as a parent, and that, you know, he is improvising and stumbling forward and not always making the right choice, he would do anything in his power to protect Robin from the world and from himself, short of lying to him. And that's part of the problem as well. When Robin starts demanding answers about what's happening and why it's happening, Theo tries to give his best possible response. Alongside that love story of father for son is the love story of the son for his missing mother, who's been gone 2 years now. And Robin is desperate to hold on to whatever memories he can. And he makes his father tell old stories again and again. And, you know, he wants to watch videos of his mother on YouTube and to hold on to her that way. And then alongside those two love stories would be a slowly emerging love story on the part of both of these lost boys for the world of the more than human around them, a recovery of the sense of their connection to the world beyond the human world. It's something that calms Robin. It's something that fits in with Theo's own professional exploration, and it's something that brings the two of them together. The increasing sense of just how much intelligence and strange alien life there is everywhere around them.
Then we come to neurotherapy, and that's, of course, the major plot device of this book. What is it?
So I first learned about this strange technique of decoded neurofeedback back in 2013. I think the technique itself is a little more than a decade old. The first research papers started to appear around 2010. It's still in its infancy, but it's growing rapidly. It's a number of different kinds of techniques, but the basic outline is that one person will have their brain recorded in real time by fMRI while they're performing a task or learning how to do something or participating in an emotional state. And that recording of real-time brain activity is saved as a kind of template. And then a second person, also being scanned in real time by fMRI, will be trained on that template, will be given feedback about their own neural activity, and that feedback will direct them closer and closer to emulating that state of neural activity in the template pattern. I've compared it a little bit to a game of blind man's bluff, where the machines are calling out, you're getting warmer, or you're getting colder. And the second person learns simply by being aware and attuned to their own thought processes, when they are actually starting to become congruent with the thought patterns of the original person. When I first read about this, I just got goosebumps. It was the strangest thing. You know, it just seemed like some science fiction postulate. And I thought, this is an empathy machine. You know, if it ever came into a robust maturity, it could be this strange answer to the question, you know, what does it feel like to participate in the thought processes of another person? You know, we are deeply tuned to read other people. We are extremely sensitive to the smallest muscle movements in a person's face. You know, as I look at you now and you look at me through this two-way portal, you know, I can imagine that I'm participating a little bit in your emotional states. However, we're always uncertain because we're not sure whether we're getting the tip of the iceberg, whether we're reading correctly what lies below the surface. This machine would be a way of opening up and participating much more directly and robustly in another person's emotional state. And so I take this existing therapy that's used a lot now as a kind of treatment of PTSD and other kinds of trauma, and I just push it a little bit down the road. I use this kind of science fiction trope of the near-term future and the reader, you know, as they begin to read about Robin training on the patterns of other people as a way of learning how to control his emotional states, you know, with luck, the reader is saying, could this happen? Is it happening now? Might it happen 2 years from now or a decade? Or is it completely impossible? So you enter into that slightly ambiguous, speculative fiction zone with regard to what exactly is happening to Robin and what result it could possibly have in his therapy.
And I don't want to spoil the plot for anybody who hasn't read it, so I don't think we'll pursue that. But
okay.
I wanted to ask about Flowers for Algernon, which also leans heavily on Plato. And I wondered if you might just tell us why that was an inspiration remind us of that great classical work of science fiction.
Sure. So while I was telling the story of this 9-year-old boy who's undertaking this treatment, I realized that its ultimate effect would be as a kind of rapid training in emotional intelligence. It would take this 9-year-old who was filled with fear and filled with rage, acting out, you know, unable to control himself. And it would gradually, through this almost video-like game that Robin excels at, increase his ability, his emotional intelligence, and that he would be going from this state of wildness into this state of wonder and control. And it rang a bell with me. And I, you know, at first I wasn't quite sure why it seemed familiar. And I knew that somehow I was recreating some other story. And then it occurred to me, and, you know, quite wonderfully, that I was, in recreating Robin, I was channeling my own childhood in a way. And a story that I had read when I wasn't that much older than Robin himself. And it was Daniel Keyes' Flowers for Algernon, which I read when I think I was 11. And in that story, someone has a kind of science fiction intervention with regard to his cognitive intelligence and goes up the curve of intellectual ability and gradually, you know, becomes a different person because of this, you know, this enormous enhancement of his ability to reason and think. And I went back to that story and I discovered that Daniel Keyes had used an epigraph, as you said, from Plato's Republic, and particularly the section of the Republic dealing with the allegory of the cave. And as most people remember, in the allegory of the cave, you know, we're all chained in darkness and we're facing the wall of the cave where, you know, these shadow puppets are playing out dramas, and we're mistaking the play of these shadows for reality. And someone breaks out of the shackles and gets out of the cave and goes outside and, you know, discovers the sun and realizes that that we are living in some kind of limited, closed version of reality. And there's this much bigger world outside, comes back in, tries to tell everyone, and that doesn't go very well, as is often the case in stories that explore the limits of our ability to know where we are and who we are. And Plato says this famous line, and, you know, as translated most classically into English, the mind, like the eye, knows two kinds of bewilderment, one going into the light and one coming out of it. So, you know, as we travel in from the cave into the brightness, we're blinded. And as we go from the light of day back into darkness, we're blinded again. And I thought, yeah, that is my story. It, you know, it wasn't that I was recreating flowers for Algernon. It's that both Keyes and I were very interested in retelling the allegory of the cave and how we can glimpse the limits of what we can know about ourselves and others for a moment. And that's bewildering. And then we can lose that glimpse. And that's also bewildering.
Now, you have these parallel stories going on through the narrative about life on other planets, which is Theo's day job. And they come as bedtime stories for Robin. And they seem to get closer and closer to real life as the plot unfolds. And I just wondered if that you could explore that for us.
Yeah. So it turns out that one of the very few things that calms Robin and one of the very few spaces that father and son can have together are these excursions that they make together in their imagination across the galaxy to various planets that are so different from our own. The planets themselves, you know, Theo is drawing on this explosion in his own science about the discovery of other worlds that lie beyond our solar system. And each one of these excursions that they take is to a planet that resembles planets that we have now discovered and verified. And the trick then is for these, you know, the two, father and son, to say, what would life look like in these very strange places that are so different from us? So it's a safe place for father and son also to talk about difference. I mean, Robin is deeply traumatized by the loss of biodiversity, as many children are. He's kind of a pantheist. He believes in, you know, he gives the more than human the kind of sanctity that most people only give to human beings. So he's deeply moved by this question of what would life do in these other places. For me, you know, it was a recreation of a form that I love a lot, which is the planetary romance, the imaginative journey of, you know, short interludes like explored by Italo Calvino or Alan Lightman in these tiny micro chapters that are in a sense a novel all in themselves that only lasts a page or a page and a half. But I've interleaved them with the dramatic story. So when father and son go to these places, the reader can look at them and say, ah, they're actually exploring their own hopes and fears in each of these places. And every place they go has something to do with what's happening to them in the story at that moment.
At one point, Robin has Theo's password and he sees really distressing images on the internet. And Theo, who's by now homeschooling Robin, wonders, how did real teachers handle this? How did they manage field trips that you write, that field trips without faking the data or ignoring the obvious? Right. He says that the world has become something no school child should be allowed to discover. How do you deal with that dilemma? I mean, obviously our children need to know what's happening. They are the ones who are going to have to take action, but how do we tell them without completely freaking them out?
Yeah, that's a horrible thought if he's right about that. Robin is very different. There's no denying, you know, that his intensity and the way that he looks at the world moves him away from the mode on any distribution curve of kids his age. But in one regard, he isn't unusual. And that's the degree of eco-trauma that he's feeling. I believe that, you know, both anecdotally in my life, but also based on studies that are coming out with increasing frequency, polls, that eco-trauma is one of the greatest mental health threats to young children. And it's not okay to tell them that everything's all right, right? Because that doesn't suit them well. I think the way forward is complicated, but realizable. I think if we can explain to our children that there is a moment of great crisis, and that it is scary, and that certain old things are disappearing, but at the same time, that life is incredibly resilient. It has survived many mass extinctions in the past. The world has developed great resilience and invention, and that there will be a world in the future, and we will occupy some part of it, and there will be meaning and work for us to do in this new world. Perhaps rather than bombarding our children with the sense of desperation that we're feeling, and this, you know, the sort of daily defeat, if we can alter our own consciousness and see the possibilities of engagement with a future that will look different from the present, will locate meaning in a different way than we do in our current culture, that message of fear and change and upheaval can also become one of possibility and recommitment and rehabilitation.
Yeah. Now, you wrote this book, as you said at the beginning, during the pandemic, and of course, in the dying days of the Trump administration. Mm. And in the work, there is this president who tweets and all the rest of it. And as you say, this is a near future novel. Mm. But I wondered how sort of living under that with Trump, with the pandemic, affected the work.
Yeah, very strongly. And I do try to play in the same way that I play with the kind of counterfactual or adjust the strength of what's possible with decoded neurofeedback. I also play with the geopolitics of the last couple of years. So as a reader enters into the book, there is initially this invitation to say, ah, yes, I know where we are. We're in 2019 America, and I recognize the key players and the key events. But as the book goes on, you know, as you say, the speculative fiction nature of the book starts to replace the literal, the journalistic realism of the depiction of the present. I think the reader who says, I know where we are, starts to feel a little unsettled, starts to realize that this book is diverging in some ways from a literalist representation of America in 2019, and is instead saying, wow, I have no idea where this is going to end. These things are on a different trajectory. I thought I recognized them, but now they're moving into a new place. And the purpose for that, I think, was to recover on these alternate trajectories that same sense of deep uncertainty and distress that we were feeling at that time. None of us knew where this was going to land. I was writing this book under lockdown and watching the president begin to subvert the credibility of the elections months before the elections were held. I turned in the final draft of the novel. Actually, the last chance that I had to change any words at all was in October of 2020, just weeks before the election. So my speculation is entirely predictive about where we might have gone at that moment.
If you had a second term, yeah.
Yeah, that sense of, oh, we're not on Earth anymore, we're on a parallel planet, was very much the feeling that I was having as I was writing this book. I didn't know which story was going to end first, mine or democracy in America. Mm-hmm. And, for me, that same sense of dislocation, of bewilderment that the intrusion of the geopolitical onto this personal story represents is valid right now, because I don't see us as out of the woods. I see us in only an interlude in an ongoing story. Everything that we despaired of and were frightened of in 2019 is still around.
Richard, finally, it's really a question about hope. How much hope you have for our planet, and whether that hope necessarily involves our species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the first thing we always have to ask when we think about hope. Hope for what? If we mean by do you have hope for the future, are we going to be able to keep intact the culture that we've created, the way that we look for meaning, this kind of socio-political formation that we have right now? I don't have a lot of hope for that. And I'm not sure that it's appropriate to hope for trying to keep together something that is so profoundly out of whack and that has had such dire consequences for everything beyond the human. We're not going to get over the finish line with all our stuff. Right? That's the wrong thing to hope for. But if by hope we mean, as I mentioned earlier, in how do we tell our children about what's happening and how not to be defeated by it, if by hope we mean a commitment to continue to engage the possibilities of a meaningful future, to me, that's easy, because I do think we are going to be part of the story for some time. I should say first, I have no doubt that life is going to survive everything that we're throwing at it. It has survived many mass extinctions in the past. And I do think that human ingenuity and the capacity to project and understand and respond to a changing world is so strong. This, you know, the collective intelligence of the 8 billion of us is so strong that we will come up with ways of continuing our part in the narrative, but it will have to look very, very different. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, to me, that's the most hopeful aspect, because once we move meaning where it is in this kind of human exceptionalist and commodity mediated and individualist culture that we have right now, where meaning is just something that each of us does for ourselves, you know, by and for ourselves, to this sense of meaning being out there, you know, rediscovering and reconnecting with this interdependent web of living planet, that meaning is likely to give us a more fulfilling life and more sense of possibility and satisfaction than so much of the saltwater culture that we live in right now.
Richard Power's beautiful book, Bewilderment, is out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hall and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and also to all at the Hay Festival. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.